6:30 p.m. sharp at the New York Avenue Presbyterian Church, 1313 New York Avenue Northwest in Washington, D.C. Speakers include Mark Morial, Dr. Julianne Malvo, Melanie Campbell, Reverend Siobhan Arlene Bradley, Hillary Shelton, Dr. George Frazier, Mel Foote, Maurice Mitchell, and Dr. Melina Abdullah. For further information, visit the website ibw21.org. That's ibw21.org.
Hi, I'm Danny Glover, and you are tuned into WPFW Washington, your station for jazz and justice.
Welcome to On the Margin with E. Ethelbert Miller. My guest today is Erica Hughes. Erica Hughes is the author of Ankle Deep in Pacific Water, published by Haymarket Books. She is currently a PhD student in philosophy at Emory University. How are you doing today, Erica? Okay, let me check that sound again. Can you say something?
I'm doing great.
Okay, great. That sounds, you sound great. Okay, you look great. Everything's great. You know, I met you, I was looking at this, maybe about 7 years ago. And when I read your book, when I'm and congratulations on Ankle Deep in Pacific Water, I feel you found your voice, okay? But I feel that you had to navigate pain and silence. Would you agree with me?
Absolutely, I would agree with you. Yeah.
Elaborate on that.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit complicated. I think the biggest thing that I had to navigate was this play between the history of Black life in the Bay Area, which is not often talked about, the migration there, and then also this kind of tearing with domestic violence that seemed to be predicated by a particular kind of like corporate or systemic violence. Mm-hmm.
So you made those connections in your work.
Yeah, I've tried to make the connection between what happens in the sort of home life of Black people in relationship to the kind of systemic violence that Black people face on a kind of daily basis. Mm.
I remember a joke. I think when I first met you, I was happy to meet you the first time. And I mentioned Cave Canem. And you had never heard of it, right? And then Cornelius Edie happened to come into the room. And I said, Cornelius, stay away from her. because it seemed like everybody had heard of Cave Canem. But you haven't. And I felt that was good and bad on two things. One, it meant, and then when I see it, you became a Cave Canem fellow. I think that's really beautiful because what happens, it shows that need for writings of color, especially African-American writing, to have a community that's very, very important. Take me through after that joke, okay? You must have Googled Cave Canem or whatever, but you apply. Talk about preparing to apply for Cave Canem, getting the acceptance, and then going to Cave Canem.
Yeah, so like all Cave Canem fellows, I got rejected so many times.
like how many times did you get rejected?
Maybe three times.
Wow. Yeah,
three or four times. If you go to Cave Canem, there are people who joke about being rejected eight times. So, you know, I felt I was in the middle. Yeah, I think after that moment, I remember, I think it was at AWP, I think you also gave me like a syllabus. And I remember just buying a ton of books and I would just sit at a coffee shop and read. And I did that for like 2 years. and so I really like, because I'm sort of a product of California public schooling system, which is terrible. If you go to California public schooling system, it's like second to the South in how bad the funding is, just a lot of problems in the public school system. I just didn't have a lot of time to spend with African-American writing, especially specifically poetry, more so the novels, but not the poetry. So after I sort of did like a crash course in African-American poetics, I started my MFA program, and I think it was one of my goals, it was to get into Cave Canem before I graduated. So I applied before my MFA at Northwestern, and then I got rejected. Applied again when I was at Northwestern. I got rejected. And then I got waitlisted. And then I got pulled off the waitlist. And then the pandemic happened. So then it was maybe a year and a half between my acceptance and getting to Cave Canem. And when I went to Cave, it was amazing. It was honestly really fantastic.
Who did you work with? I mean, if people are...
Yeah, so I was with, that year, it was Evie Shockley, Frank X. Walker, Janice Harrington, and I believe it was David Marriott, who's a British poet. I think the person who had the most profound effect on me was Janice Harrington. Janice is a fantastic teacher. Evie too, those two writers, but I think Janice and I sort of connected on a kind of like poetic plane that we understood this what you mentioned earlier, this kind of play of silence, this kind of what nature has to offer in terms of metaphor for Black life. And my first book, you know, I deal so much with land, so much with water and mountains and landscapes. And so Janice really, like her class really just spoke to me on so many levels. So
okay, well, let's hear. I wanted you to read some of the poems from Ankle Deep in Pacific Water, and I want you to read the first two poems, After a Beating and Rippling Through the Dark.
Say it again.
After a Beating.
After a Beating.
And then Rippling Through the Dark, and we can talk about those two poems.
Yeah. After a Beating. I offered my mother the cracked alabaster jar of my child body, trying to heal the wreckage of us. She sat beneath the window on our black love seat in our one bedroom apartment, her left hand curled like a branch under her chin. I approached, laid my forehead against her shoulder as if to say, I didn't mean it, mommy. She stiffened and lifted my eager head from her body. Now, she said, they'll take you away from me. I sat in the empty seat beside her, watching the light of the afternoon spill through blinds, refracting off white walls, striping my mother's honey brown face blue.
Listening to Erica Hughes reading from her book, Ankle Deep in Pacific Water. I looked at the last line in this poem, After a Beating, and I was fascinated how in one line you use three colors. It goes from white, honey brown, and blue. I say that in terms of one, sometimes poets, you know, are more concerned about sound. But in this case, you know, I'm looking at a painting. I said, wow, you've got three colors in one line, where sometimes you could read a person's poem and, you know, they may convey it through, you know, like snow or this or that. But I like how the actual words are there. And then the other thing, which I saw in your poem, and I'm going to ask you to read Rippling Through the Dark, I like how you end poems, okay? And read Rippling Through the Dark, and then come back and talk about how you end poems.
Yeah. Rippling Through the Dark. My mother wakes at night to clean the dishes. The dog on his back snores as she passes through the living room like a ghost in a floral nightgown. She's always been the elusive love in my life, expansive as memory over a battered body. The moon, dignified in the sky, peers through the kitchen window with the will of all its light. Light traipses through water, and water envelops my mother's hands. How her hands have torqued my dark body, a kind of light I have never understood illuminating the past. Here are my mother's hands scrubbing my dirty dishes. Here are my mother's hands clutching a belt like a horse breaker. Here are her hands holding the larynx of a broom, punishing my body like God, my God, who loves me and clutches me by the throat, says, I'll beat you like a bitch off the street.
Okay, Erica Hughes, talk about that ending. You know, I mean, it's extremely powerful. I know sometimes poets have a problem ending a poem.
Yeah, I also had problems when I was younger, when I was earlier in my career ending poems. There's two things that stick out to me about people commenting on my work, the end of my poems, which is I try to explain too much. I would get to a powerful end and then sort of cover it over. And then I had one professor say, don't blink at the end of a poem. So then while I was writing this book, I tried to not blink at the violence, because so much of my work was just trying to tarry with a particular kind of like interpersonal violence and a kind of corporate violence. And then someone else said something really, I used to play basketball back in the day. she said, my poems jump stop at the end. Mm-hmm. They sort of are declarative in a sense.
I thought you were dunking on it.
Yeah, on the exactly. Reader
like, I thought you were dunking on the reader. Those last lines were just so dumb.
And so I think I had to learn, and now I think I'm a lot better at it, is to not cover over what I had to say. It was already very difficult to get to the point of utterance, which is why my poems tend to start slow and sort of build. So the end of my poem is sort of, my poems tend to be the culmination of what I've been trying to say.
Well, you know, we look at After Beating and Rippling Through the Dark, which you just shared with our listeners. I go back to what I see when I open this book. Mm-hmm. The two poems you read are for your mother, mm-hmm. and your book is dedicated to your mother. Talk mm-hmm. about how you had to resolve this sort of the poems as well as dedicating the book to her.
You know, I feel that this book is both my story and my mother's story. So much, I've always been sort of a history buff, and I love sort of the history of humanity, and then also like within that larger history, African-American history, and how we've sort of had to tarry with this larger thing we call civilization. But then I have always tried to relate that back to myself. And my mother's story has always been sort of my story. It's always something she openly shared with me. And I realized in order to understand my relationship with my mother, I had to understand her history. And her history was being the grandchild of sharecroppers, and a child of a janitor and a maid. In a quite dysfunctional situation. And I wanted to understand why my mother could relate to her child in such a way, what drives people. And so there was this driving question that never shows up in the book, which was, how do I unmake myself of violence? And that was the question for me. It was like, how do I do this? And one of the answers I came up with was trying to understand the violence my mother endured and subsequently the violence that my grandparents endured. I hope that this.
It seems like you also talking about how we sort of, I guess, inherit trauma.
Yeah, definitely how we inherit trauma, how we, the stories we tell ourselves to either cope with the trauma or to never get over the trauma. I think that was the key difference between me, is like I sort of needed it to make sense, even though trauma is not something that makes any sense at all. Mm-hmm. So a lot of it for me in this book was trying to understand the layers, and not just the inheritance of a particular kind of like family line, but just sort of the overarching, like what anti-Blackness does to Black families, particularly ones who are poor, and particularly ones who don't make it into the middle class.
Talk about how you handle God and punishment, especially in the, you know, I feel that in Rippling Through the Dark, it's like the Old Testament. You talk about your mother, and you also talk about your mother being the elusive love in your life.
Yeah, you know, when I was younger, I mean, obviously one of my grandmothers was very religious. Both of them are religious. And so God was always sort of like, my mom likes to tell me you didn't believe in God as a child, which I find really interesting that she said that to me. I still don't understand why she said that to me. But God was always around. And when I was a child, I would say that it wasn't, God was never a felt presence to me. It was a picture in my grandmother's house. This kind of, you know, my Nana specifically went to a Kojic church. So it was sort of like this sort of like cultural pulsating experience in a Black church that I would just sort of be an observer. And I never really felt it. My brother, super religious at a very young age, was a singer, all these things. And he would be like, you know, caught in the spirit. And I would be like, I don't know what this is. I don't know what this is. And but I also had this experience that from my family that God was deeply related to punishment. And so I was being punished. And so a lot of my associations with punishment and God and the divine ultimately sort of mirrored the kind of treatment I was getting in my own home.
You know, you talk about, you know, you made reference to the importance of water, history. But I also look at sense of place. And you mentioned in your book in 2013, you left California for the first time. And I believe right after I met you in 2017, you went to Japan. Talk about, and then you, we were corresponding, you were in Chicago, now you're in Atlanta. Talk about that movement and how important that is to a writer, because I know many times musicians, when they move around, their sound changes.
Yeah, I changed when I left California.
Where did you go when you first left California? You went to
Nevada
or somewhere?
I went to school. So I played softball and basketball in college, and I got a scholarship to play. And I had never been on a plane before.
Where did you get to play?
At a very small liberal arts college in Northwest Iowa. That was the first place I went.
Okay.
And I know that sounds so strange.
This is for Caitlin Clark.
Yeah, this is way before Caitlin Clark. way before Caitlin Clark. It was a small liberal arts college, which is hard. It's hard to articulate because I was a very poor child in California. And poor children, people don't understand. California is one of the biggest economies in the world, but there's also tons of poverty. And often the people I went to school with had never seen the ocean. I think I write about that, and had never been on planes. So when I got the opportunity to go on a plane, I just went. I didn't know where Iowa was. They said, I knew I wanted to go to college. I was the first of my immediate family to go to college. So I was like, I knew I had to go to college. So I ended up somewhere.
You sound like you still don't know where you were.
Yeah, I was like, I ended up in Northwest Iowa. And when I was in college there, they took me everywhere. I mean, I ended up going to Princeton, to Chicago for the first time, to Arizona. I just never seen the country. Ever. And it's hard to get out of California. People don't understand. The Sierra Nevada is one of the biggest mountain passes in the world. So it's not like everywhere else in the country where you can just drive across state lines. If you drive across the Sierra Nevada, you'll end up in the desert. And you'll be in the desert for hundreds and hundreds of miles until you reach Denver. And then after Denver, it's hundreds and hundreds of miles for a prairie until you get to Chicago. Like, there's nothing out there. So it's hard to get around. And you have to have a lot of money to get on the plane. So it wasn't until I left college that the country opened up to me. When I got the opportunity to go overseas, it also changed me.
What type of opportunity do you have to go overseas?
So I went and I tried to teach English in Japan between grad school and college. And I stayed there for like 6 months. And what was so fascinating to me, because I'm a California kid and, you know, the Pacific and the Bay, so much of Japan smelt like California to me, like the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. So the shared space that I had when I was in Japan really made me think about the way landscapes change you, the way it stays the same. But also how influential place you know, more than anything, more than sound, I think image is what drives my work. I think
did you write about Japan? Does that appear in your poetry?
Japan doesn't appear in my work, but I read so much of this poet, this 20th century poet called Chamako Tada when I was there. And she is like a sculptor when it comes to her work. So I felt like I discovered image in Japan because I was reading her work. And then I also, while I was there, I was reading a lot of Robert Hayden. And so I sort of moved, I think to your point earlier about me struggling to find my voice, I realized it's not just music, mm-hmm. but image that moves my poetic sort of demeanor. Mm-hmm. So something has to sort of arrest me before I can sort of put it to words and then to sort of hear it. Because I do still think I write according to some kind of music, but it's far more subtle. I think the image comes first to me.
Mm-hmm. But you know, we go from the first to the last. When I looked at the back of your book, you include this birth and death chronology that you have there. You compile family history with a number of historical incidents. How should we interpret the juxtaposition between the personal and the political? And how did you select, why did you select certain political incidents?
Yeah, it's so interesting. Another interview, you read that as a poem, which I thought was very interesting. So this, the births and deaths, is like a Bible entry to me.
Bible entry.
Yeah, you know, your grandmother's big Bible that she carries, she has all the births and deaths.
Oh, right.
Bible. Yeah. That's sort of what it was like to me. And I sort of wanted to take a radical approach to that, sort of tradition. But I think I wanted to put in stark contrast my personal, what now I understand like as sort of familial violence with a kind of broader violence. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes I get often frustrated because I think, you know, sometimes people want to compartmentalize the two, but I think life is far more like jazz in that way. Sort of these cacophonies and sort of these tensions. And sort of, I wanted to embrace that tension in the births and deaths section.
I noticed that you, if you look carefully at that, you know, we have a certain degree of violence. You're an African-American woman. A lot of the violence that you document in this chronology are African-American men.
Yeah.
You know, talk about bridging that sort of divide.
Yeah. I think one of the biggest silences in this book are the men in my family who are looming there, my father, my grandfathers, who I think had a lot to do with the circumstances of the women in my life. I'll say it like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the men in my family were not very talkative at all. Mm-hmm. They were pretty quiet people. In fact, if you told them any stories, there are not many stories about them at all. But I, especially when it comes to my grandfather, Jimmy, who I've written a lot more about, I was thinking about the kind of pressure that was on him to sort of become a heavy drinker. And then the sort of relationship between that, him and my grandmother, so ultimately moving toward my mother, which then was mirrored in my father and my mother's relationship. So I was thinking often about just the kind of silence in my own family that they endure, not endure, but they sort of encapsulate in relationship to that. Mm.
Why don't you read for our listeners epilogue, which is the last poem in the book that appears before the chronology?
Yeah. Epilogue. If I write this, everything about us will be true. The turned over tables, the bat you threatened my brother with, the knife he threatened me with, the time I punched his asthmatic chest, wishing he would die. Within truth, there can be no metaphors for violence or love or violence committed in the act of love. Time is the enemy. Our former selves tacked to its walls, battered, tender, and sorry for all the ways we were wrong. I was wrong, caught in an endless negotiation with the past, with every possibility of escape lost by loving you despite mother. I am in a perpetual state of falling. I am trying to make you an archive, latch on to the stories of our bodies, along blankets of stars tell, every truth bound in a subtle balm and in the subtle leverage of pain. We might not survive the span of my need to say this.
Erica, you know, when I was reading that poem, I heard June Jordan's voice about, you know, her relationship with her father. I'm the wrong sex, I'm wrong this, you know. And I was wondering, was that might have been some sort of influence there?
I didn't read a lot of Junior when I was writing this, but that feels great. Yeah. I think I was, the story of this poem is really interesting because I had a professor ask me like what I was so afraid to say in my book. She kept sort of being like, why are you so afraid to write these poems honestly? And I said, oh, I'm afraid if I write this, everything about us will be true. She's like, oh, that's the poem, and to follow that. And so, yeah, I think the poem came from a really big push from one of my professors who was like, you have to stop covering up what you are also at the same time trying to reveal.
Hmm. Well, you know, when I look at this poem, Epilogue, my question that I would ask you is, why the use of a dash at the end of 8 lines in the poem? For me, I think the dash creates a space as well as a pause. And it appears that you seem to be pacing yourself in this poem, being cautious about trusting the memories of the past. That's my take on the poem.
Yeah.
But talk about that dash, because I remember, you know, like you, for example, sometime with Langston Hughes, you see a dash and the dash speeds up the line. But I felt that dash was like a pause in your work.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. And it was, it is definitely a pause. It is also like, I was thinking about, not just in this poem, but over the book, which I use a lot of dashes, was a kind of tethering and a kind of like, and a kind of like violent sort of interaction as well. Like it's sort of like a hard pause. Mm-hmm. It's not like a subtle, like, I think sometimes when people get to like a pause in a poem, they think it's like, oh, it's breath.
That is the story, yeah.
Yeah, like, oh, it's breath, but it's not. It could also sort of be like a hard clap. Mm-hmm. So I was sort of thinking about it in that way. Because I was sort of going over through not just the violence of my mother, but the violence that I experienced with my brother, and then yada yada, and over. So I was trying to get to the kind of the unspeakable nature of some of the stuff. And I think the dash was helpful and to like create that unspeakability. Mm.
Last question before we get to a pause in our show. that's a bad pun. But I don't want to project a label on you, but you know, many times, you know, you writers are always battling with these labels. And I was wondering, because we don't see a lot of it within African literature, would you see yourself as being a confessional poet? You know, confessional poet in terms of, you know, Robert Lowell, Leanne Sexton, the Silver Play. You know, we you can come up with those names. Usually we don't come up with the African Americans writers, but you know, I say that and because I also want to get into the things that you're studying, because I know you have an interest in psychology and psychoanalysis. So I was wondering whether, because that's your academic work, but it's also leading to the fact that, you know, these poems are confessional.
Yeah, I am definitely a confessional poet. I actually put
You say that at Calvary Condom? Did you stand up and say in the middle of Calvary Condom? Yes.
I know. I know that's a little bit.
That's why you didn't get in. How many times did it take you to get in?
Yeah, exactly. I actually put it confessional. I literally said, I am a confessional poet in my MFA application. But, I think there is, to say this, and then we have to go to a break, but I was reading Audre Lorde's love poems as confessionals mm-hmm. at that time. And so I know we love to read Audre Lorde's more political work, but her love poems are deeply personal and confessional, mm-hmm. especially when it's simply a correspondence between her and a lover. Mm-hmm. And that made me feel like I could sort of have a kind of intimate correspondence. Like Denise Levertov and a few others, I never really loved. But when I read Audre Lorde's love poems for the first time, that created a kind of opening for me.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we're going to close the first half of our show, okay? But I'm so happy to be talking to Erica Hughes this morning. Erica Hughes is the author of Ankle Deep in Pacific Water, published by Haymarker Books. And if you're looking for that book, Erica goes by E. Using. We'll talk about that. The show's on the margin. My name is Yes Albert Miller. The station's WPFW 89.3 FM.
Blues Alley is opening its doors to WPFW for two benefit shows on Wednesday, November 20th. DC's Great Guitars will feature three generations of players: Anthony Pirog and his wife and collaborator Janelle Lapine, Telecaster player David W. Chappell, and elder statesman Rick Whitehead, all playing solos, duets, and together in a full group. That's Wednesday, November 20th, two shows at 7 and 9:30. Ticket information is available at bluesalley.com/events.
Okay, we're back on the margin with my guest, Erica Hughes. Erica, you're E. Hughes. I'm E. Ethelbert Miller. I know why I abbreviated my first name, but why did you abbreviate yours?
Oh, I have a complicated relationship with my name, which I go over in the book. So E felt like a way to sort of have some kind of ownership over my name and pride with it. I think that's why I abbreviated it.
Okay, all right. I abbreviated my name because people were confusing me with a white graduate student at Howard University. But that's another. he was Eugene Miller. I went to the financial aid office and they said, "Oh, your tuition's paid for." And me being the honest guy, and this was before reparations, I said, "Oh, that's not my money." Anyway, I digress. In the second section of Ankle Deep in Pacific Water, Erica, you write about Mary Ellen Pleasant, known as Mammy, a slave born in Georgia in 1814. Talk about who this woman was.
Yeah, she was a financier in San Francisco. She was, we don't know this for sure, but they most likely think she was born a slave in Georgia. She gets free later in her life in a kind of weird and strange way. She gives like a snide remark to a white man who's asking her for directions while she's supposed to be working. And he ends up thinking that she's too smart to be a slave. And he sends her up to Nantucket, to the Boston area, to learn how to be, to learn how to read and write, to earn some literacy. And while she's there, she gets in contact with the abolitionist movement in the Boston area. After her husband passes away, she goes to San Francisco and begins to lease her money to miners. And she becomes that she inherited from her husband, his passing. And she becomes one of the richest Black people in California because she is leasing to miners, which is amazing. And while she's there, she also sort of establishes another sect of the Underground Railroad and is ushering slaves who are brought to California to work in the mines up to Canada and to freedom. Because at that point in time, states like Oregon, you couldn't even be Black in the state of Oregon.
Why don't you read the first poem, The Accounts of Mamie Pleasant? You have this one, Truth and Lies.
Yeah. Call me a great financer, a witch, Queen Esther, whatever you need to justify my long-standing status as a free woman and why I was the one who possessed all that money. It does not matter how I got here, I am, despite all those years I spent fighting. There is nothing new I can tell you of the horrors of captivity. Yet I can tell you of my husband's kind-hearted eyes and the hook scar just above his lip, and how I threw myself into the service of the underground after his death. You see, south of the Canadian line, freedom slips the imagination and the circadian rhythm of justice is interrupted. For the slave, there is no such thing as leisure, only the constant intrusion, only the bleak memoirs of loss and confinement. There is no more time or respect or patience left in me for white people who own slaves, nor those who think the plight of the Negro is himself. Friends make up all kinds of myths about me. They say, Mammy Pleasant, is it true? You knew John Brown and handed him all that money for Harper's Ferry. I say, it doesn't matter if it were true, though it is. But like the night sky, I have tried to hold two truths. I know the path to freedom is mysterious as losing your mother's face in memory. Hoodoo or not, I did whatever it took to steal my people home.
Erica Hughes, once again, that last line, I did whatever it took to steal my people home. It's like a really good way of ending the poem. Why don't you also read on Harper's Ferry, A Journey to Meet with John Brown on page 42.
In the bright eye of summer, I carried the promise I had made my dead husband as a pendant around my neck, almost 2,500 miles into the freedom terrain of Canada. In Windsor, I knew there was only one investment that could be made toward the final push for freedom in the United States. I was one of John's secret donors, knew nothing was to be gained if one was unwilling to spend or to take up arms. On the way, a man told me John had a stunning blue, ocean blue eyes, and I thought about the Pacific. Once the Portuguese explorer Ferdinand Magellan stood at the edge of the New World and called this new sea peaceful. Even in San Francisco, a Negro could be dragged back south in chains. Once I saw a fugitive woman be torn from her husband and loaded onto a clipper that disappeared into the jowls of the Pacific. By then, I understood what happens to the Negro in water, had grown so tired of the disappearing. I could no longer care if my life was the ransom for rebellion against chains. In California, I stood facing the cold visage of this other ocean, terrified by who lurks in its water, knowing what we were never to become without war.
You know, Erica Hughes, when I look at this line could be someone's thesis when you say, by then I understood what happened to the Negro in water, had grown so tired of the disappearing. I mean, that's a saturated line, I guess, for lack of a better word. But, you know, I want to ask you, how do you, you express this throughout our show, your interest in history. How do you take historical facts, merge it with your imagination, and create poetry out? You know, it's almost like a fake, how do you distill something?
Yeah, that was the hardest part of writing this book, this middle section, because I sort of, to speak to our earlier parts of the conversation, was more comfortable in confession than in persona. Mm-hmm. And then one thing that there's this essay by Cydia Hartman called Venus in Two Acts, in which she talks about critical fabulation, which is just how one imagines into the gaps in history, how one takes on what is real, also tries to use the imagination to create smooth ground. Mm-hmm. And that's what I was sort of aiming to do here. And one of the things that I had to do with Mary Ellen Pleasant was to sort of make my her concerns my concerns, which were how does one get free in an impossible terrain? She's on the other side of the country before much of the technology that they had, even really before railroads were connected. And so I had to start to ask myself, if I were a Black woman with a bunch of cash who lost everything, a husband, home, the only home that she ever knew, and was experiencing sort of the inner formations of California. I mean, it's called the Wild Wild West for a reason. California was a very hard place to live in the 19th century. I had to make her concerns my concerns. And I also had to ask how she would understand questions of love, which was something that I was trying to express in the confessional parts, but I couldn't quite touch because there wasn't a true loss. And for her, I felt that there were true moments of loss that I could sort of find some common ground with.
You had, Erica Hughes, you had four poems published in the Chicago Quarterly Review that was edited by Charles Johnson. This came out in 2021. Read and discuss your poem, Beckworth's Path, because we were talking about your mother. This is a poem about your father.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Beckworth's Path, Sierra Nevada, 2015. The oak, redwood, and laurel alike were dying or dead. Ochre and combustible as matches. My father was not as thin as I had remembered. His belly protruded over the band of the seatbelt as I tried to remember what the trees were like before they caught drought, deeply green and heavy with pines and life, maybe. How easily I'd forgotten what I grew up seeing, even at a distance. Words were difficult to find as he drove the car, sputtering at an incline. He had not wanted me to drive almost 1,800 miles alone over an unforgiving mountain through a salt desert and a Midwestern prairie, now greener than the Sierra Nevada's expanse of trees. He wanted me to find someone else to take his place on the journey, to pack their bags in with the last of my belongings. That stuff is too heavy for this little car to tow, to carry such a far distance, he said. My father has driven more than one woman he loves over this mountain. First, my mother, when they eloped. I was only a shadow in my mother's womb, heavy with an unbearable decision, to break me or to let me live. My father's eyes were on the road when he asked if I remembered the time he took my brother and me sledding. Remember how slick the ice was, how steep the slope, he grinned. I refused a response, as if to say, I remember nothing. Yet someone else's blood-staining packed sand, as packed-staining packed ice entered my mind. The crack of skull on frozen ground and my father's hand leading me up the slopes regardless. When we arrived in Reno, we stopped at a diner. He ate more than I'd ever seen him consume, a sign of sobriety. Again, he said, remember when you were little, how we used to feed the ducks bits of bread? We had fun. Didn't we always have fun? When he asked this, he seemed stuck in time, nauseated by the demands of the past. Lifting his head from the plate, he asked, I was a good father to you, right?
Thank you, Erica Hughes. Erica, when I introduced you at the beginning of our show, I mentioned that you were a PhD student in philosophy at Emory University. The only two contemporary writers I know who are philosophers are Percival Everett and Charles Johnson. Talk about the decision, when and why did you make the decision to pursue a doctorate in philosophy? And talk about, you know, you're studying the Black aesthetic. I wanted you to talk about that, but the decision to get into philosophy.
Yeah, I say it this way, I got kicked out of English departments very swiftly because I began to ask myself, what is poetry? What is Black poetry? And philosophy historically has asked the question about the ontology or the being of literature. So when I made that switch, because, you know, all my degrees are in English, I have a master's in literature, an MFA in poetry, a BA in English, but, you know, I had dabbled in philosophy prior. Like one of my, one of the theses, I wrote two theses as a undergrad. One of them was on St. Augustine and the other was on a psychoanalytic interpretation of Beloved. So I was sort of already in, always already reading theory.
And no one was talking to you.
No. I was just reading theory constantly at the same time that I was reading literature and poetry. The degree at Emory sort of works because it's one of the few continental departments in the country in which
you attracted there because of George Yancey?
I was attracted there because of the growing Black sort of confluence of Black thinkers that Emory has right now. I mean, in history, they just started an African-American studies department, a PhD in that. They just started a PhD in African-American studies department. They're sort of slowly integrating philosophy. And I think George Yancey was a big part of that, a big draw. I felt like at Emory, I could ask difficult questions about Blackness and Black aesthetics, and people would sort of listen.
What kind of questions are you asking or you've asked yourself?
Yeah. So right now there's a lot of new or coming out, like breakneck speeds about ontology, which again, is just like the study of being, like how we are in the world. If we are in the world is the real big question. And a lot of people are asking this question about Black ontology in relationship to the world. Like, is Blackness really in the world?
What do you mean by that?
So, yeah, this is a really, I'm going to try to distill it. So there's this question about the authenticity of Blackness as it relates to language. Because we're speaking in English, we're speaking in like these sort of like Western languages. There's always something that's sort of distant from Blackness. Blackness is sort of distant from the language and the world in which it finds itself.
Is that a result of colonization?
Absolutely. Result of slavery. I think more specifically, people are thinking about slavery as an ontological condition, not just sort of like an empirical sort of like experience, a material kind of experience, but far more, what does this do to one's mind? What does this do to one's experience? And right now, Emory's doing a lot of work, like George has done with Fanon, mm-hmm. and doing a lot of work reinterpreting Black Skin's White Mask, and Fanon's real use of language or analysis of language. And this kind of fragmentary experience, which is deeply, I think, is deeply influenced by Du Bois's double consciousness. And I think he's sort of retaking Du Bois and making it a sort of linguistic analysis. And so thinking about all of that stuff that's going on in Emory, my own work, I think about the ontology of Black literature and how Black literature sort of gains this word, is described as Black. And it's, to me, it's not simply because Black people write it, but there's some kind of quality in Black literature that is very particular. And so I try to analyze this and sort of speculate on the reason it gains this kind of adjective in relationship as opposed to universal literature or white literature as philosophers have come to understand it. And if you read, you know, I'm going to cut it short, but like if you read like German idealism, or if you read any of those turn of the 20th century literary theorists, their account of literature is less about articulating a kind of racialized experience, a kind of experience, a human experience. In fact, they don't really want experience. They want something else. They want something that's far more expansive they want a literature that's silent. And I don't find that to be the case with Black literature, that Blackness is looking for silence. It's looking for something else.
This is a, we're coming to the end of our program, and this is a big question, but an important one, and it's tied in with your research and philosophy. Explain what post-structuralism is and how it can enhance the appreciation and understanding of African-American literature. Because I remember when people started shifting and started talking about structuralism, you know, and the Black aesthetic, things of that sort. And then some people were like, oh, you're bringing these Western influences into, you know, blah, blah, blah. But talk about that. And I think at the end of the, what we're talking about is to enhance our appreciation of the literature.
I want to say this before I answer this question. Post-structuralism was reading so much of African-American literature, and part of its ability to deconstruct was coming out of the literature of the Black Panthers. Richard Wright was in Paris in the 50s, and he was doing so much work to influence a lot of these French thinkers and a lot of what will eventually become post-structuralism. So I want to start there. The post-structuralism isn't African-American literature, the novels and the poems that were being produced in the 20th century. The French were reading all of it. and there are pictures to
seems like if I had a subscription to Presence Africaine, I would be.
So I want to start there. But I will not try to describe post-structuralism other than that it is trying to understand the system from within and the inevitability of that system and the kind of foreclosure of that system. And that's according to Derrida. I think other post-structuralist thinkers don't believe in that kind of foreclosure. I will say, though, post-structuralism's analysis of language opens a new reading for Black literature.
Let me go with this, because we got just a few minutes. I want to connect this to you being at Kaveh Khan, to which is a whole generation of new writers and stuff. How much of these new writers coming out and have an appreciation of theory?
So few, unfortunately. I wish there were more. I will say that, like, there's an appreciation for Black theory, like Fred Moten, obviously. But I don't think people understand who's influencing Fred Moten, for example, like Wittgenstein. So people who are reading Fred Moten aren't also reading Wittgenstein. Which you should, which is just the reading practice. Even like Spiller's, people aren't really connecting her to a post-structuralism that she deeply is involved in. They are, but they aren't also pairing her with the thinkers. Even Angela Davis, she's not a post-structuralist, but
she. Let me ask you this new group, because I was reading this book, Other Influences.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of people like Harriet Mullen, Erica Hunt. Yeah. Women who were, my friend Giovanni Singleton, who seemed to be doing experimental work that sort of like, okay, they couldn't do it unless there was some theory behind it. You know, I mean, it's a completely different approach.
I will say the older ones, maybe not my generation. Okay. I think the older ones do, absolutely. But I don't know whom they're reading. And I don't know, I think the person I know who's reading the most right now, and I think it's because like the epigraph is a Fred Moten quote, is Taylor Johnson. And I think they have, their poetry to me is some of like the best being written right now, as far as like a younger generation.
What's the title of your thesis going to be?
Oh, the title of my thesis is called Without Ground, Blackness and Poetic Action.
And it must be some sort of quote that you have in the beginning of it from somebody. It's a Moten, Robert Hayden, or somebody. You must be quoting somebody.
Toni Morrison.
Toni Morrison. Oh, you're just playing in the dark. You're just playing in the dark.
Yeah.
And when will you be finished?
I will be finished I'm halfway through. It's about 2 more years.
Okay, so then I have to have you back and stuff, and we have a further conversation, because I think what you're doing, Erica, is just very, very important, and you've done a remarkable. I just look at the speed with which you've grown, the speed in which you've developed, and I think it's very admirable. So I want to thank you for taking time out to be on the margin with me.
Yeah, thank you so much for inviting me, and Make sure you look at the acknowledgments.
All right. Okay. My guest this morning has been Erica Yu. She goes by EU. So we were talking about her book, Ankle Deep in Pacific Water, published by Haymarket Books. She's currently a PhD student in philosophy at Emory University. The show's on the margin. My name is Ethelbert Miller. The station is WPFW 89.3 FM.
Election Day 1992, throngs of mostly black voters gathered in Detroit City Hall to applaud the installation of the first Democrat in the White House in 12 years. When the applause died down, one black politician said presciently, "It really don't matter. The president could be Democrat or Republican, white or black. The Dow Jones can go up or down 500 points, and black folks still gonna be poor." Thursdays at 2 p.m. beginning November 14th, Short Money Dissecting Racial Capitalism with host John Jeter explores the intransigence of black poverty and how the dispossession of the African-American community affects the nation's bottom line. That's Thursdays, 2 p.m., Short Money Dissecting Racial Capitalism with host John Jeter on WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Blues Alley is opening its doors to WPFW for two benefit shows on Wednesday, November 20th. DC's Great Guitars will feature three generations of players, Anthony Pirog and his wife and collaborator Janelle Lapine, Telecaster player David W. Chappell, and elder statesman Rick Whitehead, all playing solos, duets, and together in a full group. That's Wednesday, November 20th, two shows at 7 and 9:30. Ticket information is available at bluesalley.com/events.
This is Dr. Ron Daniels, president of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century, with an announcement of a very important event, a national town hall meeting to assess the national town hall meeting to assess the impact of the 2024 presidential election on the state of Black America and the Pan-African world. Progress or disaster? Thursday,